can get it all digitally.
Come at the table, man. Come
is that my book down there, Carrie?
It's right there next to Bob.
So friendly.
I'm going to sit down here. I'm already
okay.
Set up.
There's more in there
this
than
is Trustee Barra.
Well, he took yours.
Well, he's smart. Well, I'm going to take his.
Take his.
Hey. Okay, if we're ready, I'll be
ready.
We'll start then today with this is a meeting for the Powder Mountain Water and Sewer Improvement District. The date dated this Tuesday, the July 17th, 2018. We're beginning at 3 o'clock. We want to welcome Mike Moyal, who's our newest board member. Welcome you to our board. And Mike, our first action item today is to give you the oath of office. And so, Carrie, would you administer that for us?
Absolutely.
Are you willing to take, excuse me, wait a second. Mike, are you willing to accept that oath of office?
I am.
Okay, great. And Carrie, if you'll both stand and raise your right hand.
Raise your right hand. Repeat after me. I'm Mike Moyal.
I'm Mike Moyal.
Having been appointed to the Office of Board of Trustees.
Having been appointed to the Office of Board of Trustees.
Of Powder Mountain Water and Sewer Improvement District.
Of Powder Mountain Water and Sewer Improvement District.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Or affirm.
Or affirm.
That I will support.
That I will support.
Obey and defend.
Obey and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And the Constitution of the State of Utah.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office.
And I will discharge the duties of my office.
With fidelity.
With fidelity.
Very good.
Welcome, Mike.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Do you have a kind of a speech, any kind of a prepared, you'd like to get a dance, maybe?
I do, actually, not dance, but I do have a...
Well, Chris, you're supposed to bring food at the first meeting.
I want to thank you guys for giving me a chance. I look forward to doing my best here. I want to apologize if I rubbed any of you the wrong way in the past as a customer and just trying to get something done.
Great, thank you. You'll learn a lot here. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
Good.
I'm going to tell you right now that having worked for a quarter of a century with different groups, I have a lot of confidence in what Roy and Carrie are doing. We're so lucky to have them in our district, running our district. We're very, very lucky. It only takes you the experience of working with other districts or with other boards to know that we've got great, great people here. And I want you to know I have complete confidence in their ideas and suggestions. And while we have the privilege of being able to talk to or with or against or for or whatever that happens to be, they're really, really good, and I have a great deal of confidence in them. I just speak for myself. I don't know the other trustees, but that's what I have to say about that, so to speak. We also, present today, we have then Trustee Moyal. We have myself, Jim Harvey. We have Mark Scritel present. We also have... Trustee Bob Barrett, and on the phone, Gary Urdane, you there?
I am here, thank you.
Very good. We also, Roy, Carey, and we have LeGrand Bitter, who is the executive director or the head cheese for all the water districts
the bottom of the pile.
of the state of Utah. We welcome, is that correct?
Yes, Utah Association of Special Districts.
Utah Association of Special Districts. Welcome you here, Mr. Bitter. Thank you. Very good. We'll continue with our item number C, our public comments. Seeing no public here, except for you, Mr. Bitter. Do you have anything to say?
I don't.
Great. We'll come to that another time, and then we'll then move on to item number D in our agenda, which is approval of consent items. I'll read those now for the record. Item one is a request for approval of district bills to be paid. Those are included in your packet. Item two are warrants number 411 to 427 in the amount of $71,017.91. Item number three is a request for approval of the minutes for the meeting held on May 21st, 2018. And item four is an authorization to ratify payment made to Barnett Water for Summit's invoices in the amount of $8,438.10. Chair, I'll entertain a discussion on the motion or on the consent items.
I make the motion that we approve the
I'm
consent
not calling
items.
For a motion
oh,
yet,
sorry.
Just a discussion,
sorry.
But thank you for saying something. To the staff, Roy and Carrie, are there any items in particular you'd like to have us No or more?
No, just mentioned that let's see, Carrie, we decided about half of this is reimbursable, whether it's coming to the O&M fund, so whether they're coming from the loans or the impact fees or from Summit reimbursed, for those will be reimbursed to district. So
right.
It's a lot of money, but a lot right now is construction season, a lot is happening.
Very good. Great. If there's no more questions, yes, Trustee Barron.
Relative to the minutes, Jim, just a point of clarification. I don't believe they need revision per se, but on item D, the attorney's report from Rachel last month, there was a reference to Powder Mountain West subdivision phases. I want to have that clarified as representing the district in total, not just Powder Mountain.
Okay, very good.
It was a catch-all reference to the entire district, but it does say Powder West subdivision.
I so think by virtue of those minutes, I would like you to make, if someone would make a motion to have those amended in, as such, I'd appreciate that.
I move that we amend those minutes to reflect that clarification.
Great. Could I ask that you, Trustee Barrett, to move to approve the consent items with that as well?
I move that we approve the consent items with the amendment for clarification on the minutes.
I think everyone's clear on that. I'll entertain a second.
Second.
Thank you very much. Call for the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. We'll now move on to item E, which is the USAD, or you said with the grand bidder, the district in with regards to district compliance. Mr. Bidder.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, and I'm here and happy to answer any questions that you might have. I understand that things have been going through some adjustments the last many months and several years. a number of years ago, I think we were talking earlier, mm-hmm. a piece of legislation that we actually ran in 2014 that made some adjustments to as the district continues to grow and get into a situation of being in compliance with all the elements of state law. Just to kind of give you maybe a brief overview of a framework with respect to governance. I've been working with Roy for the last several months in this capacity, but actually probably a whole lot longer than that, since the early 90s. He mm-hmm. was, as you know, the manager of Roy Water Conservancy District for many years. And
I think they named it after him.
I think so, yes, it was Roy's district. And really enjoyed working with him in that capacity. As you may know, there are some requirements in the statute for training, for example, for board members. All public officials are required by statute to receive training each year on the open and public meetings law. You're familiar with that. District board members have some other training requirements in the statute that are specific to districts to receive training that has been prepared by the State Auditor's Office in conjunction with the Utah Association of Special Districts. And we provide that at our annual convention each year. We also provide it specifically to some districts if they make a specific request. We also do regional trainings frequently around the state of Utah, and frequently work with the State Auditor's Office on doing that. So those are some of the requirements. Other requirements, a records officer would be appointed for each entity. I think you've done that. They're required to receive training and certification each year. And those requirements seem to be expanding as the years go by. We invite you to attend our convention each November. This year our convention will be held at the Davis Conference Center. We normally have some in the range of 350 to 400 board members and managers from districts throughout the state of Utah that are in attendance. It's a three-day conference, starts about midday on Wednesday and goes through about midday on Friday. And it's a great place to not only receive training, but to cross-pollinate with a lot of other board members throughout the state, address issues that maybe you may have. We have legal counsel there for addressing a variety of issues in our breakout sessions and a variety of other things. So I think you'll find that useful and a good place to make certain that you receive the training that's required as well. If there are some specific areas where you have concerns, I'd be happy to address those. I know that I was pleased to see you administer the oath of office. That hasn't been being done very much over the years. We've included that in our training the last number of years. And so we're glad to see you doing that. There have been questions, ongoing questions from boards about, I noticed in your bylaws that you have some items that you're considering with respect to compensation and addressing that. And maybe I can address that just briefly a little bit. We've had some issues over the years. Back in the 90s, they put some caps on the training. The cap was $3,500, compensation, excuse me. And I can tell you exactly where the cap came from. There was a situation where a board member, my background, just to give you a little bit of background on where I've come from, after graduating from college, I went to work for a couple of years with the state auditor's office in the late 80s, and then worked from about 87 through 93, well, actually it was about 2001, with a special service district, a large one, served 15 counties and two cities, and then did a variety of other things. And been with the association since 2005. In this particular situation, there was a board member that was receiving compensation. Things were really active with this particular district. They were in a period of construction, litigation, a whole variety of things going on. And at a point in time, we're actually holding one meeting every week. And the chair and other board officers were actively involved in a whole variety of meetings and obligations. And so the way they structured their compensation was, I think it was $100 or $150 per meeting that they attended. And the chair had certain other obligations, so they essentially took the total amount of compensation, divided by 12, and that's what the chair got, just that flat amount, because he was attending sometimes one or two dozen meetings a month. Rather than tallying the meetings, he couldn't go above the compensation limit, so that was it. One particular board member was keeping track of all the meetings that he attended, which was appropriate, but one of the elements that he called a meeting was a phone call. So he would call the district office frequently, at least once a day, and check on how things were going, and that was recorded as a meeting. So his compensation was relatively good-sized, and that came to the attention of the legislature, and they read a bill, you know, this is what's happening, fine, I'll fix it, and the legislature runs the bill and they fix it. So that's when the $3,500 cap came into play. Subsequently, about 10 years or so ago, we were able to get that increased to $5,000, which is nice. I guess it would be a suggestion that compensation be tied to attendance at board meetings or an activity involving the board that's reasonable. There are some reasons for that. We had a bill run 2 years ago that was, I don't know what the problem was that gave rise to it, but there was something somewhere. And it dealt with per diem and compensation. And the bill applied to all government entities in the state of Utah and essentially said, cities, towns, counties, districts all now need to be following the per diem rates established by the Department of Finance, which has its problems. I've been in discussions with the Department of Finance to adjust a few things that I think are not appropriate, and they agree, actually. They have flexibility that we don't. It's just the way the bill is structured. But I serve on some state boards, just to kind of give you an idea. And in the state statute, State Department of Finance, they have allowed $60 for a half-day meeting, $90 for a full-day meeting. District statute has not said that. This bill a couple of years ago came really close to requiring that, but doesn't at this point. It's nice to have a little flexibility in that regard. We nearly lost that flexibility in addition to this bill I'm talking about 2 years ago, because the state auditor's office became aware of a situation in another area of the state with a district that was holding two meetings a year, which was not in harmony with state law, because state law requires four meetings a year, reviewing the financial disbursements once a quarter at least. But nevertheless, this district, which happened to be a kind of a developer-created district, which resulted in part of the problem. In these two meetings, they compensated this particular board member who happened to be an elected official in another capacity. Probably should have known better, but 5,000 divided by 2, 2,500. He was being paid $2,500 per meeting for two meetings a year. And needless to say, that raised the eyebrows substantially in the eyes of the state auditor. And I was afraid they were gonna run a bill and essentially take compensation away. They didn't. They did investigate the situation. In private business, that's perfectly fine. Not a problem. Some of you likely come from private business. So that's not a problem. In private business, you serve on the board, you get paid a very substantial compensation package. But in the government arena, it's just a whole different ballgame. And there are things that are legal in private business that just aren't in the government arena. For example, a situation a few years ago, we had a individual elected to the city council in Syracuse. Professionally, I think he was an architect or an engineer. And within a month or so of him taking office in the city council, he received a finder's fee for helping another firm get a job with the city. And a finder's fee, that is cash. And under the ethics law, if you receive any cash, it is a violation of the law. Normally that's a true-false question I ask, because the statute says a public official cannot accept or solicit gifts, compensation, or loans, and that includes employees as well as board members. Although an occasional non-cash gift of $50 is okay. But emphasis on the non-cash. The statute says non-pecuniary, and I had to look that up because I'm not an attorney, but it means non-cash. So one penny in cash is a violation of the state ethics law. Well, he got this finder's fee in cash, and he was investigated and charged by the AG's office. He was removed from office and went through a prosecution. So I'm not sure where the city attorney was, but nevertheless, these types of compensation that are perfectly fine in private business, they just don't translate to government service. So our counsel is just to be very, very careful. And to set up a compensation structure would be our suggestion. It could be the 60 and 90 for a full and a half day meeting. If you chose to do that, it would certainly be in harmony with state statute and you wouldn't have any problems. I think there is more flexibility than that. I think 100 or 150 in that range, I've seen that done. I think that's probably somewhat reasonable and wouldn't be become a flashing light. But just be aware, and I tell districts this all the time, if there is a situation that is that becomes a concern to private citizens or to the public or the press, there will be a door knock to their legislator, and he will look at it, he or she, and he'll say, "I'll fix it," and they'll run a bill. I mean, we've had these types of situations every single year. So that would be our suggestion. Some districts as well in the past have had difficulty with having board members, not all, but on a few occasions, attend their duties and attend their meetings. And the financial side is, you know, having them compensated per meeting is a nice way to address that. If I attend a meeting of a state board that I've been appointed to, compensation is only received if I attend the meeting, and that's just kind of an illustration of that. I think if I believe legislators are treated the same way. I think if they became aware of a situation where individuals were receiving compensation regardless of the form of government, without having to attend a meeting or something, I'm confident that they would run a global bill that would affect everyone. So I just kind of give you that background. The decision is yours. There is some flexibility in the statute. It was eliminated to some degree this last year or so in some areas. But I would encourage you to just kind of be sensitive to that a little bit. Some would say, well, why the 5,000? In some cases, we could have a limit that would be higher and it would be useful. In other cases, some entities just can't afford it, so they pay none. I'll give you an example of a situation where it is very useful. As you know, the statute says that it is a violation of the law for an individual to be a board member and an employee of the district at the same time. Cannot happen. So they can be either or, but not both. So in some cases, we have very, very small districts that may provide water service, and it's kind of a working board. They have no employees, and so a board member has a track hoe, or a back hoe. We want him on the board because he's got resources. All these three board members are certified water operators, and there's a problem in the middle of the night. He hops on his back hoe, goes out, digs the trench, fixes the problem with the others, and it's done. So the question is, how in the world do they deal with that? And in this case, they can be compensated up to the $5,000 per year, reimbursed for their actual expenses, which is not included in the $5,000, compensated for time at a reasonable rate, up to the $5,000, but if they put in more hours than the $5,000 cap, they cannot go above the $5,000 cap. So that it's been used as a nice tool where we've had that type of situation as well. So I don't know if some of those observations are helpful or not. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them. We don't have any desires to harm or hurt anyone, but just kind of giving you the dynamic of some of the things we see, and I want to kind of protect that flexibility for you and for other districts. Board member qualifications, do you have a question?
No. Okay.
You're probably aware of the qualifications, just some general things we do in our trainings with local districts. Board members are required to live within the boundaries of the district and be a registered voter at the place of their location. There are some exceptions that I think in a bill that was driven by Powder Mountain, I think, and Cedar Mountain Fire Protection District about 7 or 8 years ago, we ran, and it essentially says if there are more than 50% of the homes that are not, that are seasonally occupied homes, they live elsewhere, then members, individuals who own land or property who pay the fees within the district are qualified to serve on the board. So there are some exceptions in that regard. An agent can be appointed to serve as well. Ethics, I think we've talked a little bit about that. That's an important thing. We just encourage, as I mentioned, public officials cannot accept or solicit compensation, gifts or loans. Don't accept any cash. Ethics with respect to procurement. We went through the procurement, substantial recodification of the procurement code about 4 or 5 years ago. It took 3 years. We spent a full year after that dealing with the ethics issue by itself in negotiating how this is going to come down. We have private business people, we have county commissioners, we have mayors and city council people, and they're all serving on these district boards, and some of them have totally different ethics statutes, a different ethics statute in the county code, a different one in the city code, and then we have the Public Officers and Employees Ethics Act, which district board members are subject to and district employees as well. Then they wanted to have another ethics level applied that you would all have to comply with in the procurement side. So we spent this year, and in a nutshell, it boils down to this, to make it simple. In the statute, when it says you can only accept an occasional non-pecuniary or non-cash gift of $50 or less, from the time the procurement begins to the time that the procurement ends with that vendor or contractor, the word occasional is taken out. That's it. So you got some consistency there. The State Officers and Employees Ethics Act, in a procurement with that contractor, the word occasional is out one time. When the procurement ends, the word occasional goes back in. What's the definition of occasional? Well, be wise, because you don't want to lose that flexibility. But just be wise and careful in that regard. Conflicts of interest under the ethics law require, the statute requires full disclosure. One question is it required to be in writing? Well, I had an attorney ask me that a few years ago. He said, LeGrand, would you please find for me the form that our board members need to fill out to disclose their conflicts of interest? And so I started checking around, trying to find one, and I couldn't find one. So I went to the Lieutenant Governor's office, who's kind of the gatekeeper for legislators, on their disclosures of conflicts of interest, and he said, Lieutenant Governor told me, isn't a requirement for local government. So it is a requirement for legislators, and you're aware of that. But is it good practice? And certainly. Well, we do have a number of districts that require that their board members file written conflicts of interest on an annual basis and have it the file. In addition to that, we see legislators in committee meetings and on the floor of the House and the Senate who make verbal disclosures of the conflicts of interest whenever something comes up that may affect them. That's good practice. And so if you want to do that, make it a requirement, you could as a district. You don't have to, but you may. If I were serving on a board, I would view it as a protection to me to have a written conflict of interest statement and file it voluntarily with the district, as well as to make certain that I always disclose anything that I even think I might have a conflict of interest on, disclose that.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Okay. Roy, don't we have that already?
So far, everybody's filled them out. I guess Mike, you'll have one that you'll need to fill out, but yeah, it's important. Just with what Grant is saying, it's critical to have it just because you want to protect yourself.
Yeah. Protect yourself.
Yeah. Go overboard on that, in my opinion. Another question is, does disclosure of conflicts of interest protect you from all violations of the state ethics law? And the answer is, no, it does not. And one example of that is one area in the state ethics law where it says an individual public official may not have a substantial interest, I think it says, and I think I've got it here actually. Let me see if I can find that real quick. Apologize, just one moment.
Well, that's still loading. Back on the board member qualifications, I know that was a concern that a couple of board members had about how that all works. And there's no question from the trustees that more than 50% of the homes are seasonal. Am I understanding that okay?
We went through several iterations of what might be called data mining.
Here you go. Yeah, and so that means that you would only need a proportional share represented on the board that were actually homeowners there. So you probably need one board member as actual a homeowner. Probably everybody else could have representatives if they wanted to, it sounds like to me.
You could. If you want to have proportional, you could. Part of the driver of this is that if you have a dozen people that live there year-round, it'd be kind of a burden on that small number to have them all serve on the board. Although, if you had a five-member board, you could have four of them be those individuals and one of them be an agent or a person of another another flavor. So it's really quite flexible. Another thing that we wove into the statute here over the last couple of years that was not allowed previously was geographic areas, the district divided into geographic areas. So you can have representation from various areas if you choose to do so.
So it mentions that here in this statute that you can. I think that was brought up maybe by you, Bob, but what do those divisions mean? It basically means the board can divide the district into areas if they want, but they don't have to.
That is correct.
Everybody can be at large, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
That was a thing that was run a couple of years ago. We had a district of Salt Lake City that ended up one election or appointment cycle of having all the board members be from one neighborhood. And of course, other people in the district didn't feel too keen about that. And the statute thought doesn't even allow for you to do it. So then we ran the bill a couple years ago that gave you that flexibility. If you want. The ethics statute says you may not have a personal investment in any business entity which will create a substantial conflict between your private interests and your public duties. That's just an example. That says period. Doesn't say unless you disclose. So
say that again. You can't have a what?
You may not have a personal investment in any business entity which will create a substantial conflict between private interests and public duties. That's 6716
Tactical Babes.
Nine, I think it is.
And when you say period, you mean that that can't be tap danced around with recusal when those issues occur?
I don't know. I know it does not say unless you disclose, is my point. The disclosure doesn't.
Well, I understand that distinction, but recusal to me seems to be
recusing
a powerful mechanism.
That could occur. See, if you look at the state legislature,
right.
That exists there as well.
Got it.
But just be careful with that. Just
got
be
it.
Very sensitive. Okay. If you own equity in a business and that business is bidding on a job for the district, and they get the job for the district, and there's financial money flowing through. I shared an example earlier of a district that called me a couple of years ago. The chair of the board worked in private business. He worked for a private finance firm. Well, it just so happened that their district at the time was going through a refinancing, and they were using his firm as the financial advisor. And he gave me a call and asked me what I thought about it. And I said, well, when we're done talking, the first thing you need to do is call your attorney. And the second thing is decide which one you really want most. Because obviously, he was slated to receive a commission check for $500,000 when the deal closed, and which is more than one penny in cash. And so he said, you can... If you want to protect yourself and avoid criminal penalties, you would want to either pull yourself off the job and receive nothing and remain as the chair of the board, or resign as the chair of the board and take your $500,000 commission check. And I think that's what he chose to do. So the point is to protect you. The point of all this is to protect you as board members and public officials and employees. And don't get yourself in a situation where this friend of mine, the Syracuse City Council, found himself. So just be cautious in that regard. If you have questions, some districts require that their boards read the state ethics law every year, sign it, and put it in the file. You don't have to do that. Some do. UTA does, for example. But it wouldn't be a bad idea to do it, just so that we don't want anyone who's serving on these district boards to be caught in a bad situation and be harmed or damaged. You're not getting wealthy at this. Even if you receive the $5,000 every year, you're not getting wealthy at it. And a lot of board members don't receive any compensation. It's really a public service. So reading through the ethics law, the reason we would suggest it is so that you're aware of any of the little nuances in there that may exist, and it would be a protection to you. We just want to make sure you're in good shape, protected.
Thank you.
Let's see if I have any notes here that are general in nature. Do you have any questions at all about?
No, it's been helpful. I mean,
is that helpful?
And you represent a resource moving forward, or the special district does. I mean,
absolutely.
We have access to your website. We all should be able to get to that, and that's a thing of beauty. And
Yeah, and the other thing is, as he mentioned, that training that's coming up, the chance to be able to go without a lot of expense to the district and be there, you know, share war stories, listen
yep.
to what's being said, and that's a huge benefit right now.
Perfect.
For everybody, so that's a good
okay.
deal.
Now, Carrie, do you have the best practices checklist?
I just handed it out to
excellent.
Yep, right here.
So let me just talk about that just very briefly. This came from a legislative audit that was performed about a year and a half, well, it came out about a year and a half ago. It was performed over a couple of years, 3 years ago. What happened was the legislative auditor general was asked to go out, and there really wasn't any real focus to the audit. They just went out and dropped in on various government entities, districts, interlocal agencies, nonprofits, and a whole variety of them, just to see how they were doing. This came from that. And there are other bills. There's going to be another bill this year that came from it. In a nutshell, the legislative auditor general came up with this list of 27 items for best practices, and try to see if I can see that. Where is? Okay, this is good. There's another item somewhere. Okay, there's a list of 27 items that I will get to Roy and Carrie and have them provide to you. That list was sent to every government entity and district in the state of Utah a little over a year ago, with a cover letter signed by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. Those two gentlemen are the chairs, co-chairs of the Legislative Audit Committee, saying, boards, we'd like you to kind of use this as a guideline and a focus, boards and management. And so what we suggest is that boards and management take that list and use it kind of as a checklist every year to go through and see how you're doing. Some districts have taken those 27 items, put them in a spreadsheet in column one, column two, they list what they're doing in each one of those areas, and column three, any changes that need to be made. So if you're looking at something with respect to board duties and kind of things that are hot buttons that the legislature is looking at and the legislative our general is looking at, we would suggest you do that. And I will, I've got that on our website, I think, under statute and resources. You can put that on.
I'm talking about that. Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
Well, thanks, LeGrand.
You're welcome. I hope that's helpful.
It's very helpful, and I wish we would have had it a year ago. In some cases.
And you're welcome to call me anytime. I get calls from board members and employees all the time, and if you have a question, please give me a call.
Well, we had a board member that used to come in for 5 minutes and then take off. Mm-hmm. That was, to me, that's not right.
Yeah. I can mention one more thing briefly if you want as well, in that regard. We had a person on our board, Dan MacArthur from St. George, a number of years ago, and there was some talk about some districts not being able to have some muscle to get their board members to attend district board meetings and perform their duties.
And Dan MacArthur or Dan McConkey?
Dan MacArthur. Dan MacArthur, he was the mayor of St. George. Okay. He, for a number of years, he said, LeGrand, cities have that tool in the statute. We have the ability to compel. So he said, if he had done it on occasion with the St. George City Council where they had a controversial item come up, and he would call the police chief in and say, Chief, go down and get Councilman so-and-so in your car and drive him up here. He is not going to skate on this thing. He or she is going to vote on this issue. So I thought that was interesting. So anyway, the next year, we went to the city portion of the code and we ran a bill with the same language that cities and towns have that allow for that ability for the entity to compel, and put that in our statute as well. So the bottom line is, districts, if they choose, can utilize that to compel and use as some muscle if you have a situation that is not working well. That method is not in the statute, but it allows you flexibility. So anyway, I appreciate the feedback.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Really, board members, is there any discussion regarding this? Great. We'll move on. Appreciate that, Mr. Bitter. Thank you for coming and helping us with this. We appreciate it.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Board, we're going to move to item F on our agenda, which is Blake Hamilton.
Okay.
Blake, it's nice to finally have you here. Gary Blake's in the room now with us. Blake Hamilton. And so,
okay.
Blake, if you'll cover items 5, 6, and 7 for us. The first 5 is a discussion and or action on adoption of a resolution for policies and procedures.
Okay, with respect to the policies and procedures, it has been a very painstaking process. I appreciate your being patient on that. At this very moment, we're trying to finalize the policies. I have emailed the bylaws to Kerry. The big issue with the policies and why we're trying is, if you notice, they were very, very expansive. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was a lot of direct language quoted from statute in the policies. And so my practice has always been that instead of doing that a reference is made to this section, the statute code section, instead of actually regurgitating the entire language. And so I'm going through I've been going through, and actually Gregson, who works with me, is finishing this off right now, synthesizing that so it just has the section code number. So instead of having the actual language, you have the code number. And the reason why that's, I think, a better practice is that every time the legislature meets every year, they modify these statutes, and you would have to go through every year and make sure you change every word in your policies to track with the statutes. And instead, now all you have to do is go through and make sure that the numbers haven't changed. And as long as the statute numbers haven't changed, or it hasn't been renumbered, the statute hasn't been renumbered, then you're okay. So that's why it's taken so long, and that's where we're at with it. But I think what it'll do is make it a lot more consolidated and easier to get through, and so that you don't have to spend hours and hours and hours reading through the policies. But it'll still cover the breadth of area that you need.
So the context of the whole policies and procedures stay the same. It's just a legal cleanup that you're doing.
Legal cleanup, basically shortening it so that it's not such a voluminous document.
I'm good with that. Yes.
And so what I have often seen and with boards like yourself is that when we're at this point where we know what the substance is inside the policies, is to pass the policies, and I've drafted a resolution so you could pass the policies pending final legal review, and I'll finish that process up, and obviously that will be circulated to you, but that will be the final version once we have that cleanup done.
Okay. And these are them that we were just handing?
That's the bylaws.
That's the bylaws.
Okay.
So the policies are the ones that are
okay, sorry.
There those, were multiple.
Yeah, those should be emailed to you.
Okay.
They were in the last board packet I sent out. Yeah.
Okay, great. Is there any discussion on this?
The only thing that I saw in the, and when you're saying policies and procedures, you're also including the human resources manual that accompanied that.
Yes.
The only thing I saw in that was, I just wanted to bring up was, you're committing to some pretty strict policies with respect to employee reviews, mm-hmm. particularly, and I don't know if you want those documented as stringently in case you fail to do something on a timely manner and then you have to dismiss an employee. I know you have two employees.
That was real troublesome. Yeah. I actually a lot of what's in there I dealt with almost every one of those situations.
Yeah.
And so when we actually created those, it was because every time it was an incident.
Yeah.
And we got burned because we didn't have something in the policies and sued, and it's like I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of those, you damned if you do, you damned if you don't. But I just found the protection every time I ran into a situation where some employee was doing something stupid, had to have the policy, or otherwise in court, and the attorney just goes, "So did you have a policy on this?" I'm like,
yeah.
"No." It's like, "Oh, you're in trouble. This guy's gonna win. You're always wrong, and so it's gonna cost you a lot of money." And then so I don't know. It's tough, but I've been in trouble in most situations, and mm-hmm. you just end up covering your butt with some policy, unfortunately. But so I'm aware of the problems, and I felt more comfortable with more than less because I've been in trouble without more. So I don't know.
And I tried to be very respectful to Roy and the fact that he'd been through these wars and making sure that every issue that he previously had was covered.
It's tough to do.
I mean, you're the one that has to administer them. I just wanted to kind of bring it to light that sometimes, I mean, I guess I'm a little more sensitive because we have 450 employees to make sure that we're hitting every date that we say we're hitting in a timely manner. So.
That would be hard.
Yeah.
It wasn't too bad with a half a dozen people or one or two. You can deal with most of the issues.
Yep.
But yeah, a lot, it would be terrible.
Okay.
Great. Is there with this, it was the, because it is not finalized, I'm not comfortable with calling for a motion to approve this. After it's finalized, then I think I'm good with taking action with the board. But until we get the final draft, that's where I'd like to go with that.
And again, and that's fine if that's how you'd like to proceed. I know Roy wanted to make sure there was something in place, but if that's how the board wants to proceed, that's fine. Again, all I'm doing at this point in time is I'm not changing the substance of it. I'm just streamlining it. So it's going to have all the same things. It's just instead of having all the language, it's going to refer to the statute section.
I'm happy to be, if somebody wants to talk me out of it. Roy, do you have any
I'm fine with that because, again, he's not changing the substance of it. He's just changing the legal references is all in there. But
okay.
So what the board feels, you guys make the choices.
Great. Thank you. Board members, are you okay with that?
I am.
Okay, great. Then let's move on, please, to item number 6, which is a discussion on and or action.
So are we making a motion?
I'm okay with making a motion pending final legal review if it's just a contextual sort of issue.
Under those circumstances, the chair will entertain a motion, please.
I move that we adopt a resolution for policies and procedures pending final legal review. and dissemination to the board for final approval.
Chair recognizes the motion, calls for a second.
I'll second.
Okay. We're just under the wire. Yeah. We have a motion and a second. No more discussion will be heard. All in favor, say aye.
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 Okay, there are four. I'm going to abstain on that one. So we have four ayes. Thank you very much. Let's go to item number six, a discussion and or action on the revised feasibility letter.
And I need.
I don't think he's had time to look at that.
What's that?
I don't think he's had time to look at that. So.
Oh, Blake, you mean? Or?
I haven't seen the revised.
Bob, if you can take, I've really got to be right back.
That was the one that I sent to Blake, and I don't think he's had time to review it yet, so we'll have to just...
I think I got it on Thursday or Friday.
Yeah.
I apologize. My schedule has been pretty crazy during that period of time. I had a case where the judge entered an order on July 3rd, so we had to do all this expedited discovery by having a case ready for preliminary injunction hearing by the end of this month. So I've been making several trips to Monticello, which is not a short trip.
So there is no revised feasibility letter?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
But just to, if you want to have some brief discussion, the revision is simply going to be that we're going to add some teeth to the fact that if they, you know, once we send the feasibility letter, if they at some point decide that they don't want to pay their fees, that they're, you know, waiving their any rights that they may have with respect to that.
This is to...
the bankruptcy such thing.
Yeah, and also to when somebody gets the feasibility letter, let them know that their standby fees will be paid, need to be paid, and there's teeth in it.
And with respect to the bankruptcy issues that you brought that up, I did do the research on that, and there is really no, if when you're charging a standby fee or you're charging one of those fees, there is no issue with respect to a statute of limitations. So that fee is, it continues to run, it's like a tax lien. So even if the person files bankruptcy, that basically runs with the property. And if the person that coming in wants to have those rights, they've got to catch that all the way up.
So we have a couple of those two developments that would possibly we could go back on, but is there statute of limitations?
No.
What if we were not sending them notices?
That's the main issue, is that they have had to receive notice that there was this fee and this obligation.
Keep reminding them every month almost, is that what we had to do?
What?
And for sundown.
Not every month, but you would have to be able to show that they had proper notice of the obligation.
And for the people who were looking to potentially collect on retroactively, what type of notice have they been given at this point?
Previous to me, nothing.
Okay.
But they have been... Well, and I needed to ask Blake the question about the will serve for Powder Ridge, but they Sundown has received theirs. They have agreed to start theirs. But previous that I can see, when he took over, it was 2008. Nothing since. So when it was brought to our attention that there was even anything out there is when that conversation started. But remember the rescinding the will serve. We need to ask about that.
What
Blake says.
That. So if we have a will serve that's been issued to, say, Powder Ridge, can the board rescind that and basically say that since you haven't been paying your fees, that now everything starts over and you basically don't have those reservations and those resources are gone? Or is that still something that they had because of a previous approval by the county?
The permit was actually pulled. So the county pulled everything because they had not, the foundation is in, the footings and foundation, that's as far as it got. They did not proceed, so the county pulled the permit. The paperwork is in there. The county pulled the permit, but according to the county, because they already have a will serve, because they were not issuing feasibility letters, they don't have to come to us if they want to continue. And we're asking, can we legally pull that will serve because of the situation they're in with the bankruptcy and everything else? And the county's making them start over with everything and their plans. Where does that leave us?
If the county is making them start over with everything, including their plans, I think I'd feel pretty comfortable defending you to pull
the will serve
letter.
Okay.
And what I would hope in the future is that when we address this issue, that it's in the letter that if they start failing to pay those fees, that you have that right to be able to pull anything.
Anything in the future, okay.
I mean, that's part of what we're talking about, putting teeth in there, that's what I mean by it.
Got it. When you, in our old will serve letters, was there any stipulation about paying standby fees at that point, or?
That's why we came up with the feasibility letter, because it didn't state any, they just automatically went straight to the will serve, and that was it.
Okay.
So.
And you have notice then now at this point?
Oh yeah, they've got their notices and they've got their invoices and yeah, so we'll go take it from there.
So we're starting from now,
July
1st. For those two developments, and one other one, which one?
No, it was just Sundown and Powder Ridge.
Oh, I think there was those two up on by Powder West. But yeah, so we're just now starting to re-notify them, and Carrie's been great at keeping, putting liens and everything else to keep them notified.
What about the, I don't know the name of the project, you guys probably do the horrible slant bunker there at the corner of the parking lot?
Yeah, that's that.
Oh no, that is Fast Track, and they have actually been paying their fees all along and to date.
Okay.
And they're entitled to 7.
So.
Mm-hmm. So, do we have any further discussion on the revised feasibility letter?
I do. just one last thing. So we're saying for Powder Ridge, we're gonna say, okay, you don't have will serve anymore, and instead we're gonna reissue feasibility, or we're gonna reissue will serve.
Feasibility. And that's okay. Providing and, depending on how they proceed with it.
And again, so we're issuing a feasibility letter, and they're going to pay fees on the base after we issue that? That's the plan?
No, yeah. They haven't asked for the feasibility. They're going to start paying fees now.
Okay, but again, so then that gets the third thing that I bring up every month, which is they're going to start paying fees, and they have no guarantee of getting water. Is that correct?
Right. That's why I asked about the will serve, because as of right now, the county considers them able to get it. And so we're going to pull it.
If we rescind the will serve, then they pay no fees until they request a feasibility.
Well, that's where we're at. That's why.
Right. And then
they're not paying fees right now. Right. That's the way I understood it. So by rescinding this, you're not, I mean, just making sure that it's clear that they don't have the right.
They don't have the right to proceed, right?
And then they won't pay fees at all until they submit a new request for a feasibility letter. And then once the feasibility letter is issued, then they will begin accruing fees again.
Well, with the discussion where they have already had, like Sundown, I mean, they didn't ask for the feasibility or anything. We just, you know, when they came to us and said, where do we stand? That's where we were at with the feasibility, and you know, they haven't been paying, so do they actually have the rights now that it's come down to the fact that, yeah, they actually have them? We issued it, we sent it off, they agreed to pay. We're still trying to deal with Powder Ridge, but as of July 1st, we have the invoices been sent out, we're going to figure out where they're at. But that was our biggest question, was if they wanted to proceed wherever, however, the county wouldn't have come to us for anything. So, in all honesty, we couldn't have reached out.
And how many months or years of standby fees is Powder Ridge paying?
How many did they pay, or how?
How many are they agreeing to pay?
They're supposedly 30. They are supposedly entitled to 30.
30 connections.
30 connections.
But are they paying?
They're not going to go back retroactive.
They're not going to retract. It'll start July 1st.
July 1st.
Just because we have not been noticing
them. Yeah, okay. Right. I'm just trying to get this clear in my head. So,
that's it. Oopsie.
That seems to be very clear in the statute. It's just that you have a notice requirement.
Yeah.
If you haven't been giving notice, then trying to go back and say, hey, this whole time you were supposed to be paying this fee.
So
pretty difficult.
Basically, with Powder Ridge, until, because I mean, if we just notice them July 1st, we're not even out of July. They're not delinquent until we get to August, so we really can't take any action on them until that point, can we?
Yeah, I wonder about that same thing too. If we send a notice and they automatically start paying, where does that leave us? Or they're no different at that point than Sundown is.
Right.
Jump back in and get going again.
And then I'm just kind of thinking through the process that if they've been noticed in July, they don't pay, they don't pay, they don't pay. We get to the point where we send them a notice that we're rescinding their rescinding their will serve letter that is existing. 10 months down the line, they decide they want to restart the process, they apply for a feasibility letter, we're not going to forgive those fees then, are we? They're going to have to pay
the
back fees?
They are continually ongoing regardless.
Okay.
They continue whether they pay or not. The lien goes on after 4 months.
Okay.
They get the 90-day letter. After that, the lien goes on. And according to the stamp, this everything that he pulled up, they continue on, period.
Okay.
And they get collected before anything happens.
Yep.
So the only thing that would change that is if they went to the county and vacated their development and just went to raw land.
Yep.
One lot.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with that, Blake?
Yeah.
What we're doing?
So.
So.
Go ahead, Gary.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead,
yeah,
Gary.
So just I guess Blake. I mean, so it's okay for us to say, sure, you have to pay us every month for 30 connections or so, and when it's time to build, we just say, yeah, well, we don't have any water, sorry. Thanks for your money.
Yep.
Explain why that's okay.
Okay, so and so I actually put together a one-page sheet that I think
does
a pretty good job of explaining that.
Okay.
And really what is what the standby fee is allowing for the district to plan for the future. It's not
mm-hmm.
any kind of guarantees. And so by paying that, you're just you understand that you're allowing the district to plan for the future and to get the infrastructure in place and all those other things, but it's not guarantee you that it will be there, because there could be unforeseen things that create situations where the district doesn't have the ability to provide the service. So
gotcha.
That's why it's allowed, and there is a good property ombudsman opinion on that exact issue. So I think we're on good ground
okay.
there.
Okay, so let's go back to the name of some of these things. These are named what they're named because by law they have to be named that, because, you know, saying fees, you know, standby fee versus planning fee or reservation fee or get in line fee or anything that would be more descriptive seems to me to be somewhat less, and again, I'm not suggesting we're doing anything bad, but bait and switchy.
Okay, so the reason why the standby fee was used is that's what the opinion from the property ombudsman looked at, was a standby fee that a district was charging. So it's kind of a term of art that other districts use. And again, as long as the notice, I don't think you have a bait and switch issue. As long as you're providing this notice about what the standby fee is, the person is on notice of what this is and what they're entitled to, and the fact that they're not really guaranteeing or reserving any right to service.
Okay, and just I guess one last question. So when they get this notice, which I presume is, you mean the feasibility letter?
Well, no, there's a feasibility letter, but there's also like a one-page handout that I put together.
Gary, I just emailed it to you if you want to open it up and look at it.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Blake.
So that's what I was talking about as far as the notice. I mean, the feasibility letter will also explain it, but the one-page handout really just walks through what a standby fee is, where it comes from, and what its purpose is.
Okay. So our hands are tied in terms of making this a little more customer-friendly, but we're okay legally.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And I think you're more customer-friendly, too, because you're actually providing them with notice about what this fee is instead of this nebulous, what is the standby fee?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, to springboard off to some of Gary's concerns, I think this sort of clarification on a legal basis in terms of what technically a standby fee is and a feasibility letter and all these sorts of things is germane to these new developments, if you will, that have historically been senescent or springing up or whatever. But there's a substantive group of homeowners within the existing district, okay, that have for years been paying standby fees under the assumption, and assumptions, you know, people have assumptions all over everything, that this was in fact a guarantee of water service, that somehow that this step did represent not an opportunity to get a feasibility letter and ultimately a will serve letter, depending upon snowpack and well drilling and all that. So that's going to be a tough sell with that crowd, I'm just telling you.
I think the thing that's important about it is that it says that it's a no guarantee, but this board is the mindset with its master plans and studies and its
yeah.
commitments and its resources has proven that it's preparing to take care of them.
Yeah.
I think that's the key part of all of that, that anybody could look at any part of the business that's being done and see that you're taking care of them.
Yeah, and I understand those distinctions, certainly. Yeah. You'll be invited to the annual homeowners association meetings to explain.
And if they come and they're exactly able to show why they had, if they have any kind of evidence that indicates that they had.
I know, it's so much oral history, hearsay, yeah, innuendo typically.
Let me just ask this question then. So got it, understand what we're doing as of today. In, you know, a couple of months, and you guys are going to report on this in a few minutes, when this well is drilled, we will actually know how much water we have. Mm-hmm. Could we then, as a board, make it a policy that we're going to hang on to that water to satisfy all the commitments we've made, including, I know we have an agreement with Summit as well, and change this kind of, I won't say nutty system, but somewhat less than intuitive system into something, you know, that's fairer. Notwithstanding that it's legal what we do right now. Thoughts?
You can do what you want, can't the board?
Yeah, I mean, the board
has a lot of control and power to do that stuff if you want.
Right, the board can make those decisions about how the resources are going to be used moving forward. I mean, that's well within the right of the board. I mean, I'd be very careful to overcommit yourself, though. I mean, because again, you don't know what may change with respect to that well and the water that you're going to be getting out of that well.
Gotcha. So we still need some legal caveat, although it seems like a better caveat, hey, the well stopped working versus, hey, we just decided to give your water to somebody else.
Yeah, definitely right, when the well's proven and you have that resource and your infrastructure in place, you know what you're going to be able to divvy up. I think it makes life a lot easier right now. There's just some iffy things.
Yep, gotcha.
Yeah, but again, the board has tremendous control and power to do pretty much what it wants, and so that's up to you guys.
Carrie, did you hand out the standby information sheet? So
I can get it printed real quick.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see what it is, and so we've already started using it and sending it to.
Okay. By the way, I didn't get that email. I don't know what happened, but.
Hold on, I'll get it to you again.
Thanks.
With what's being said, does this board have a desire to take action on the revised feasibility letter?
No.
Okay. Wait a sec, I just hear one. Is there a board member that would like to make a motion on the feasibility letter? None being heard, none being recognized, we'll move on. We're going to move on to item number 7, a discussion and or action on adoption of resolution for standby fees. Is there action from this board that would like to be taken? I'll actually call for a motion. No motion being recognized, that dies. We'll have to hold it for another time.
Got it.
Blake?
That's okay. I mean, I think the standby, we've got the rate set. We're already sending out, we've already sent out the standby fee information sheet to developers and let them know and already told them that we're needing to pay these things. So I think, I mean, the resolution was just making that valid, that what we're doing is actually what the board wants done. And we just had a discussion about, had a lengthy discussion about the standby fees, so I don't know.
Are you comfortable with the standby fees?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
The standby fees are your operation and maintenance money.
Yep.
Okay.
So what is the monthly fee?
It depends on where you're at, and if you have strictly sewer rights, or if you have, and Carrie, I don't know.
It's $87.60 for Powder Mountain West in the old district. It's $102 for Summit, and it's down in the preserve for sewer only is
$39.68. Okay.
So it depends on whether you have water and sewer or just sewer.
Right.
And it's consistent with the fees that were passed last year, right? Mm-hmm.
Those are
the exact
numbers.
So these are existing fees, just so we know.
But the resolution solidifies your commitment to collect your money.
I will then, I'll ask the question again. Is there a nomination from the floor regarding adoption or of a resolution for the standby fee?
I move that we adopt the standby fees.
Motion recognized. Is there a second?
A second.
I have a motion and a second by Gary Erday. No more discussion being held. I'll call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? None. Motion carries. Thank you. Blake, no more grin on your face. I think we're good to go.
Hey, I'm just...
Item number G. Thank you. Our manager's report, Roy Watts. If you'll take, I hit item 8 through, was it 12 or 13?
Okay.
8 through 13.
So we've pretty well covered item number 8. I guess if you're, again, if all of you will go, we would really appreciate it. We'll get you
registered
and ready to go. You can attend those meetings, drive down and go to them. And we will pay you for attending those meetings too, like LeGrand was saying. So, but great conference and be good information for all.
Got it.
Just let Carrie know. Also, on the wanted an update on Cobabe and also the Bloomington well. Right now, Cobabe, they're only at 300 feet, struggling to get through that rock. It's probably still about 6 weeks out before they get done drilling. We're just hoping that they get into some softer material. They're really struggling. But I just look at the mountain, and for those who've been up there know that there's probably a few hundred feet of heavy rock that you have to get through before you start getting into some of the looser material.
Points.
Yeah. But they, other than that, it's probably 6 weeks out before they get down there. So you kind of have to know where things are going. They've had a few troubles. They had a breakdown last week, killed them, lost some time on. But again, they're just drilling, just moving ahead, but I think they'll be okay. I think they'll be okay. Let's see, the Bloomington well, they ran their test, and Mark, you probably will have as much information on this as me, but we haven't received a report back from Loeffler and actually final, really giving us good information about what happened, but word was 300 gallons a minute was the test, of a 24-hour test, and we're designing and building right now the well house for 200 gallons a minute. I think that covers safe yield pretty much. And so, again, with that final report we'll get from them, we'll have to make that final decision about the production. But we'll build that with a variable speed drive, which allows to tweak the flow a little bit. There are some, I think we sent those out to you, some design, let's see, yeah. I think Carrie sent that out to you. It was just showing the well house.
They're in there.
It just shows you what the well house looks like. They're doing a great job. The engineers have reviewed those. Our engineers have been over that. Mm-hmm. Ann was communicating today with our engineer, trying to get the final plans all back and get that all taken care of. And so we've made a few tweaks. It should be a great facility when it's all completed.
Okay.
But That's about where that's at, but it looks like the comment was that they're in a great aquifer, that it was producing well, that there wasn't any, I think there's a 200-foot drop, if I remember right, from a static level in the total pump. The other thing was they watched the Hidden Lake well. There was no change in the aquifer at all, so it appeared that it was staying stable and it was separate from the Bloomington aquifer. Long-term pumping will probably prove whether that drains down into it or something. I don't know. But right now, the test all looks good.
So are we, and I guess I should know this since we're drilling the well, but I don't. So I'll ask you the question.
Yeah.
I mean, long-term operation with that, are we going to cycle pump those or based on the flow valve readings from the tanks, or are we going to run one?
Yeah, great question. I spent about the weekend thinking about this whole thing. It leads into the discussion about the amount of water that's available.
Yeah.
So now we have three wells. This is the reality of this whole thing. So now the district will have three wells, and you have very little use.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have to cycle those and have to develop an operating plan that allows us to keep those wells operating and keep the aquifers functioning. And the other concern is that even right now we're having to manage that reservoir level very carefully because we're watching contaminants want to build up in those tanks.
Yeah.
So what happens, and I talked to Bob a little bit about this, you know, we could produce in the hundreds of millions of gallons of water per year with a need of maybe 10 million gallons. it shows you how much excess there possibly is up there. And this leads to probably what Summit had suggested at some point is to talk to the state engineer about our true use and get our water right, get the water right approved, but then go back and really take a hard look at our peak data based on actual our peak months, and then get approval to drop that 400 gallons a day peak down to something that makes sense.
800 down to 400, right.
Yeah, and that actually gives you a ton of water for sure. Your developments. And we need to encourage people to sign up and hook up and develop because we need to use the water. And we need our sewer system to run.
Right.
The sewer lagoons, we're having a hard time keeping those wet. Mm-hmm. So we have to figure out how to get some makeup water down there. So any use of all of those would be good. Any development would be good, whether it's Mike's or whether it's Sundown or Powder Ridge or Summit growing like crazy. Now we need customers for that reason.
The health of a well is going to be dependent on being used, and that's why I was concerned, because I've been through a similar situation where I had 1,000 gallons a minute capacity out of 5 wells, but in the summertime there were 2 months in the shoulder season where we needed somewhere around 60 gallons a minute. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was hard to keep those wells healthy.
That's what I'm worried about. Yeah. I worry as much about that as ever about having enough water. We're going to have buku water.
You got spillage without a Cache County mitigation plan.
Yeah.
Can you do snowmaking?
Probably could. I think there'll be enough.
There's not, I mean, even at even assuming we took 30% of our capacity and we were able to allocate 200 GPM to snowmaking, that's a drop in the bucket. I mean, that's 4 guns. So it's
gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, we would need a reservoir, and then we could cycle pump the wells and fill the reservoir from that. But being able to construct a reservoir would be number one costly, but number two, I don't know if we could actually get a permit to remove groundwater and retain it as surface water.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Another thing, I just, as a point of information, touring the Weber Basin water storage recently, they're actually, and it's not really experimental, but down in South Weber, below the pit, northwest of their big pits, they actually take some of their excess water and pump it into they have a reservoir kind of looking thing, but that water that they pump, and they're pumping it so many gallons a minute, leaches down into the ground and then goes back into the aquifer. So they're taking the water from their source and putting it in the ground, into the aquifer, and saying, okay, we're using this for water storage in the future so it doesn't evaporate. So they're using the aquifer as storage, and then they get to use that water in the future for the state if they need it for a rainy day. It's kind of the rainy day fund is that aquifer. Mm-hmm. It's a diversion off the river somehow, because they control all the way up to Echo, all the way, they control all those big lakes and waterways.
I mean, we're basically high-fiving each other under the assumption that we've got so much water, swimming pools for all. But, and it kind of dovetails into a concern that I raised at last meeting relative to Bloomington and the testing methodology. Mm-hmm. I'm one of these trust but verify sort of guys on testing methodology. I've seen it a lot in my other life, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that the district has firm control of the testing methodology and can make sure that that's meeting our needs, okay? The practical reality is the engineering firm that's going to be providing us data is employed and contracted with the developer. And once we take over those wells, if you will, once we issue an operating permit, then in fact we have committed to those will serve letters that we've issued, mm-hmm. and that capacity has to be there. So it's a caveat, it's not a drum to beat, but I want to make sure that we're involved and that we've actually looked at this. Because the high five, we've got 3 wells. Mm-hmm. That's 2 wells if all of a sudden Bloomington doesn't prove out, or we get a couple more drought seasons, or if there is an occult sort of intercommunication, or if these feeding seeps that go into the aquifers dry up in drought conditions. a whole different story. You know, I just want to make sure that we've covered our bases on the testing methodology and make sure we're good there.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly what more we can do, but
we'll review the data and look at it with a clear recognition of where it's coming from.
Yeah, and I think it's important to be cautious in how we develop the well and then start to exercise that aquifer and stuff too. So I've had Don Barnett take a look at that and question everything he could. Paul has done the same thing. He's been fairly cautious about what's going on. And then I've been up there, and of course Evan. But beyond that, I'm not sure how much more other information we can get that'll help us.
I don't know. I don't pretend to know anything about it. That ball's in our court once we assume the validity of that data. And the duration of the testing and all those sorts of things.
Okay. And how much incremental development is supported by this? I mean, are we going to now generate a will serve for phase 2A or 3, or what's the plan?
Eventually, that's what the developer will want. They've developed a source, and we're going to, of course, as Bob said, we're going to have to be pretty comfortable what that's going to be and what it's going to do, but that's the intent, is to develop based on that resource.
Right. So I mean, do we have I have this question about the next item too, two items down.
Uh-huh.
So how do we translate 200 gallons per minute into houses? What's the calculation?
800 gallons a day for a peak per ERC. And then 400 is your average use, 400 gallons per day.
But how does that work? Is that just you take 200 gallons per minute times 24 hours times 60 minutes and divide by 800?
Yeah, yep. I think it was a 1,400 minutes.
It's going to cover the 316, right?
Yeah. I mean, isn't that somewhere around like 0.55 GPM equates to one dwelling unit.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, you take that, we'd end up with, 380 roughly?
The state will discount it by a third right off the bat.
Yeah.
Okay, but then...
Well,
they do that off
the GPM, the yield of the well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if we're at 300, we'll be at 200 is the minimum safe yield. So then
here's the second half of that question, because I was trying to see how this all works. You know, 800 gallons... Or whatever, 150 gallons per minute, I'm sorry, 200 gallons per minute at 3 a.m. is not especially useful or helpful. So how does that relate to, you know, actual demand and actual supporting houses and stuff?
Yeah, that's true.
That's the statutory requirement.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. The state engineer requires it. We don't have nearly that kind of consumption on the mountain. But that is the state requirement. Now, that's what I was mentioning, that we actually could talk to the state if we felt like we needed to and change that. Tabiona, another district in the state, did that very thing. They're very similar to us. And they had that reduced to whatever their peaks were. It was made better sense for them. They were not being required to have that much in storage and have production. So they had a smaller number. And whatever that is, we'll just have to decide that if the board chooses to. If you want to keep that same high standard, that's up to the board. But that will determine how many buildable units there are that will be allowed off of that well.
Okay, but we do figure out, for example, you know, 5 p.m., every single skier on the mountain is taking a shower. We're all good. I mean, I know we have a lot of storage capacity up top, but we certainly don't down below. That's all stuff you guys figure out when you're coming up with how many.
Yeah, when the engineer is figuring that out, they have to build for peak flows, for fire protection, and for, I think it's 150,000 gallons for fire protection for a certain sustained amount of time.
I think there's a calculation based on the amount of square footage that's protected. For fire protection, and then that equates to the amount of storage, and then they take your maximum pumping rate and figure out your refresh and make sure that your peak demand and the duration of your peak demand is satisfied by the storage that's on hand and the ability to refresh in whatever time you're seeing it's off peak is really what it boils down to. If that makes sense, Gary.
Yeah. So there will be an engineer who says, here's how many connections are supported by 200 gallons per minute.
Correct. Yep. And then, of course, the redundant supply that they need to have that also.
Okay, so the 800 gallons per minute is
800 kind gallons of an per
upper
day.
Bound, but not a lower bound, or the other way around. Yeah, well, upper bound.
Yeah, 800 gallons per day.
Per day
is what.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, that. You know, and this isn't a mystery to Roy because I know he's heard it from Ann and Don and probably me too. I just sometimes can't remember what I've said, but you know, as a developer, because of the conservation requirements in our development documents, we're going to be at some point petitioning to try to get that lowered down
right,
to around
which, 400. Which makes sense.
Yeah.
It does. It makes great sense. There's no question that there's not an 800 gallon a day demand up there. We, for 2017, for the 80-something units that we had up there, we used about almost 3 million gallons for the year. And yet you have a spring that was producing easily 6 million, and you're going to have wells that are producing in the tens of millions. So there's no question that you would have enough water. I realize what Bob's saying. I mean, you have to plan for the worst case scenario, and that's what we're doing with 800 gallons a day and 400 gallons a day for sustained use in your tanks and everything else. But all that's going into the system, and it's just going to have to. It means that as an entity, we're going to have operating policies to manage all of that, and it means that we do need to work with. Not only for the district's sake, but for with developers and everybody else to make sure that we have some type of plan with the state to utilize the resource intelligently.
Very good. I'd like to keep the meeting going if we could continue with your report, Roy. Okay. Thank you, Gary. Any other questions if you'd give Roy a call?
Okay. Did I put you to sleep again?
No. But I am. Right. I am having a birthday soon. It'll be my 80th.
While we're still young, Gary.
Yeah.
To keep it going.
No, you're fine.
Say that to that LeGrand guy. I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Okay, no, fair enough.
You're the winner,
Roy.
Okay. You got him.
You got it. Okay, so one of the things that's been the hot item is getting the water line plan started for the water from the Kobe well up so that
really
poor folks up at the Powder Mountain Wilbur district has a resource and also fire protection. And so now that we're moving along with the well, the engineer is getting us a preliminary design for the pipeline. We've been looking at well capacities, also the operating procedures that we've been talking about. We talked initially about putting 400,000 gallons of storage up around Ridgeline, but
Timberline.
Too many lines. But anyway, we're with the thought that we're going to have to keep utilizing the water out of the resource as much as we can. We may stay with a smaller reservoir for a period of time, not put the bigger one in. But in that, he's starting to size mains, looking at lift stations and other things. We're thinking they're going to put cast iron pipe in the ground, one lift station to get it up to Ridgeline, and get it into the existing wells. So there is some information started on that, but more than anything, we still need a contract on all this, but it was a matter of just getting this stuff started. So we started looking at easements and right-of-ways, figuring out what we have, what the actual cost is going to be, how we're going to tie in to the existing buildings and get those services taken care of, and then again, how far up the mountain are we going to go with this? And so I know I'd like to, my thought is to go further than just to the first storage reservoirs, but to go on all the way up to the top of the mountain so that we deal with fire protection and flows if in case Kobe well goes down, that we have water feeding both directions, look at the PRVs and how those are all functioning.
Yeah. I mean, in the interest of an integrated system, you'd want to go all the way to that 415, wouldn't you?
You betcha.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So that's, I just wanted to bring that up, that he's working on now. That's been a hot topic for the board, especially Bob and others concerned about their homes burning down.
So just a question, too. You said they're going to use cast iron pipe. Have they looked at ductile iron pipe? Or?
He was doing this mostly because they can crank the pressures up.
Yeah.
And it means only one lift station. I think what he's worried about, I think, Mark, you brought up an interesting thought that we don't know if we have the power supply to put more than one lift station. That is a whole other point that they're going to have to start researching, is how we get enough power to run the well and the booster pumps and everything else to lift this water up there, especially as we get higher, larger quantities of water rather than, I think, for that little 4-inch.
Yeah.
We get bigger mains, you're going to have to take bigger pumps and higher horsepowers. So that's another thing that we're working on.
Okay.
And then we wanted to review the easements and make sure those are all in place. And so we've been doing that, collecting as much information as we could to really make sure everything's ready to go as we start this design. We're probably looking at, again, about $2 million in costs. We're thinking that possibly we'll look at the budgets in the next little while and how this is going to work. But we should have enough money that we can go out after one more loan and get this built as fast as we possibly can. So, but we're still probably looking at 2019 for it to go together, all start to happen.
Okay.
Let's see, and then the next is that we have been discussing the amount of water that's available in the Kobe well for these other developments, questioned by a couple of board members. There is documentation supporting when some of these developments had their approvals, and we've talked about that. So we call Powder Mountain West, which includes most of the lots and properties in the old district, other than Sundown and Powder Ridge.
Some of Sundown.
Some of it was still a part of it. Yeah. But we wanted to identify that separately because it has such a large number of ERCs that they could claim. There's 72 for them. In the older district, there was we would have about 90, almost 90 in there. About 72 at Powder Ridge, at Sundown, about 30 at Powder Ridge. Mike's development would be 11, and then Summit would end up with anything that was left over in the well based on how it produces. Probably one question was asked about the, I guess I'd call it the pecking order. The older subdivisions, we're seeing that they were the first ones in line, have been there for a number of years, as Bob has mentioned, waiting for that resource. Next was probably Powder Ridge in their approval processes. Then Sundown would be after that. Mike would be in line based, if you look at his request, and Summit would be after that.
So how does that relate to what you just said before about Bloomington, where, hey, we got to start using this water, everybody who wants it, let's get going? That seems at odds with, reconcile those two maybe.
Well, again, you've got a well that the developer is using for their developments. I don't know if the district's taken ownership on them yet completely. It hasn't, definitely on Bloomington. But in the long-term operating plan that we're going to have, those wells will have to be exercised, and there'll have to be an operational plan in place to have those all running at different times in order to exercise the aquifers and the wells and also keep the tanks fresh and the lines fresh. And so they'll be operated in some way to maximize that. And as I mentioned, there's no question that if Kobe produces, like we hope and these others do, then there'll be enough water and or a need to utilize that water. Right now, there's a need for it. Right now, we need to be using water. We're dumping some water in order to keep the tanks fresh. So we don't want to spill on the ground. If we can find a use for it and sell, it helps the district out and helps the aquifers to work. It seems to make better sense to do that. There's some of these lots, based on what we've seen, they won't develop for decades. People speculate on them. And so, and they're very little use during the summertime, so you want people to hook up and you want them to start using water. It'll take a number of years before that builds out.
So as a practical matter, what you're saying is that when people show up saying, hey, I'd like some water, at least right now, we would say, here you go.
Exactly. And right. and then related to what Mark is saying, long term you're gonna say we don't need to utilize all that resource, we have enough. If everything proves out, again, this is, you know, it's on question, but if it does, then you're gonna have excess or have more than enough long term, and you'll sign people up as they come on board, you'll have enough resource to take care of all the future developments. You may even be able to do other developments that you didn't think you could, but beyond that, you'll have enough.
Okay. All right. So if someone showed up tomorrow and said, I want water, we would say, absolutely.
That's totally up to the board. That is totally up to the board.
No, but I mean, you're suggesting that that's what we would want to do.
I'm saying we should, because we need to sell water. We need to move water through that system right now. Even though realizing Summit is the one building that, those tanks need to be utilized and those wells need to be
upgraded.
I mean, you know, to put on my developer hat here.
Yep,
you know,
okay, I understand.
To protect our investment, though, we need to make sure that whatever our yield is out of those two wells, we have the full allocation of that to our development. So we can't just willy-nilly say, yeah, whoever wants water, come get water. You're going to be basically subject to the capacity of Cobabe well after existing requirements are satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Operationally, you know, we're not opposed, obviously, for the health and well-being of the entire system to commingle the water and use the water and exercise each well in a cyclical format to make sure that the wells are functioning properly and as healthy as they possibly can be.
Right. So we can't oversell
right.
or over-allocate any of these resources. But I guess kind of back to what you're saying, Gary, is that if it's people that have been planned into the system, they could come and ask to be hooked up tomorrow. But again, we couldn't go out and solicit or encourage people beyond what we have built into the system to be those allocations.
But what you are saying is that 272 or whatever the number was on Cobabe, all good.
Well, that's basically what's been committed. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
all right. I guess we'll just wait another couple of months and.
After the next 90 days, you say a drilling, we'll know a little more.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Okay.
We're talking about something where the baby has not been born yet, and we're all speculating right now on what's going to happen. We need to see what this thing does.
Yeah.
I mean, to satisfy existing commitments with Cobabe, you have to be somewhere around 200 GPM, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So let's move on to this water source distribution of Cobabe. Cobabe, is that where we are on this, if I understand? That was kind of an offshoot of the piping.
Yeah.
That's
what we were talking about. So what the allocation would be and who would be first in line to get their water. And we need to wait still another month or so to figure this all out.
Okay, great. So what about pump house design?
We talked about that.
So let's go to, as Uncle Paul Harvey would say, page two. Item number 13, assessment on engineering review on sewer systems in Lagoon.
Okay, and this is another, has been a hot topic to make sure we get this, the life expectancy of the lagoons, sewer lagoons, analyzed.
I don't have a packet here.
Yeah, you'll probably see.
Is it in here?
You'll see drawings similar to.
Something like that.
And then also there's another one in there showing the easements and right-of-ways. So we've been working on finding all of our documentation to verify our easements across the Eden Heights property, which for the most part we've done that. They don't line up with the pipe, unfortunately. So I don't know who described them, but they're wrong. But we've been doing that, as well as looking at we surveyed the actual fence lines of the lagoons, looked at the lagoons as far as their life, their quality, their vegetation, the fencing, the elevations of the ponds. We've also been analyzing the manholes and dipping in each one of the manholes to see if the flow lines still look good. So all this is a step towards looking at the life of these and what other infrastructure and things need to change. So basically, they're good, things look good. We do have some work that needs to be done.
It's an infrastructure management plan, basically.
Yeah, so, and we actually need to have a good long-term maintenance plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
But all of this is in preparation to go talk to the owner about what we're going to do.
Yep.
We did meet with the developer. Mark was in that meeting, and we felt, and I've talked to Don afterwards also, and he feels that the existing system that we have probably is what the developers will like. We're so far into this right now that we'll probably continue to use this infrastructure long term. We're good. Clear out for I wrote it down someplace, but I think we're good for another 40 years or so. So long term, those will be our infrastructure.
I have the report that was emailed to us.
Yeah, open up that flyer.
These are just all.
Yeah, I don't think we got the maps.
Oh, okay. Here's that right there.
There we go.
Here's the maps. Thanks, Gary.
I'm sorry, Bob.
So they would max out in 2030 about 1,600 population. And so we've reviewed just a number of things about the life, the easements, the right-of-ways, the boundaries of lagoons. We're looking at fence lines and replacements. Our fence lines all need to be replaced. They have residential fencing on them. Blake's looking at all the contractual issues. He'll bring that up here in a little bit. Water infiltration, future treatment, pond capacity. We're looking at the potential that we've renovated some of the lift stations and any others that need work. We're looking at the telemetry and the SCADA system, vegetation removal, possibly adding, still even considering another employee that would help to manage some of this long term.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the flow lines and depth of those and getting engineering elevations on all that. Getting our GIS map built with some of this. Sediment removal from the ponds and disposal. We've also had Paul Krauth, who's an expert at one of these sewer lagoons, has given us a review and an update on what needs to happen with those. He's actually going to dip those and decide what sediment needs to be taken out of them. They've been looked at the clay liners and see what kind of condition they're in. Also, there's an issue about makeup water. And let's see what else. The regulatory considerations and biological issues, long-term operating plans, and then again meeting with the owner about what we're going to do about payment and settlement and everything else. All of that is a part of the master plan, the impact fee analysis, and us being able to use that infrastructure and deciding whether we're going to pursue acquiring that property. As Carrie and I looked through the old minutes, it appeared that the previous boards had planned on possibly moving away from those with other infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been why the contract was written the way it was.
Right.
They anticipated that the development was coming and maybe that those weren't going to be the type of sewer treatment facility they wanted. And they were going to build another plant. They actually had indicated in the minutes that they had been looking at properties and had some identified and were working on some agreements, but that didn't, I don't know whatever happened. It just seemed like it all disappeared. But right now, based on our review, the sewer lagoons are good for till about 2030, maybe even longer, depending on what development and growth is like, and aeration and other things can be done. We also could put a smaller treatment plant at the top of the mountain. We've looked at maybe just right by sundown, and then possibly a pipe full, depending on what the flows are like. If we had enough and the water was fairly clean, we could put generation facilities along the hill because it's slope, generate some power to help offset our power costs out of that, and then do whatever with the effluent. But mm-hmm. Number of things that could happen with it long term, but it appears that is the facility we're going to use. It works. It's almost it's all in place. It'll be there for a number of years, and then we will need to look at other treatments.
So barring a lease catastrophe or coming to loggerheads with the owner, phase one, phase two, right, Mark?
Yep.
Is that what you guys?
Yep.
Got it.
I think we're set with our infrastructure and it's functioning.
Okay.
It'll be our management plan.
There's lift stations that are going to have to be constructed still on the hill, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not too many actually now, though. It's pretty flat
more,
up there, huh?
Two
yeah.
more?
Yeah, it's really what we're thinking. One out at Bobcat Ridge and maybe one a little further down. One thing, I read through the report and they made some indication that some of the berms might have some issues. Do we have monitoring wells in place downslope to see if these are leaking?
Good idea. Yep.
You know, there's been discussion about that for.
Pretty easy to see when the snow comes.
Yeah, if we get snow down there. So,
yeah. Just piezometers or monitoring wells or something just to see what if water's starting to move.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a good idea. We'll do that. Good idea. So they're great. They're usable. Everything will work okay. If we can settle the seismic problem, I think that's a big key now to moving ahead and just developing those to the max and then start working on long-term plans for the sewer system.
Great.
So the exercise has been good and the review, and we're a long ways now down the road. We feel like that we have the infrastructure we need and our easements and right-of-ways, we almost have those complete to where we'll have those all protected all the way across the property. That was a big concern that we had. And then the other concern was the condition of the infrastructure, and we'll bring that all up to grade, everything up to a current standard in the quality of the infrastructure and everything else so it's usable long-term.
Very good. Let's move on, if we could.
Okay.
To item number 8, our treasurer's report, Carrie Zanger.
Mine will be quick.
Thank you.
Okay, we placed 3 liens. We collected on 2 past huge amounts, finally.
Good.
Your bank balances were as of last Thursday. So there's $86,000 in Zions, $32,000 in the general fund in the impact. And then I need to have Bob come over with me. We need to get Wells Fargo closed, and then we'll get the other $13,000 wired in, and we'll be done with that. So I just had to wait for the reconciliation. Amy's been down. We finally got QuickBooks moved over.
Good.
How was that? Process. A process. But it's moved over, and she's going to reconcile everything up until the end of the month. Good. So we'll have the auditor actually do all of that. I just have to go in and do some chart of accounts and move over a couple of things, and she can come in and audit, and then we're good. We'll have Wells closed out, and then we'll just move forward as of August.
Very good. August 1st.
August 1st. So, yeah, we should be done. And then, actually, come next month, we should have a good, clear P&L for you.
Very good. Okay. That's important for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so your PTIF right now, you're looking at 246. So there you go. That's it. The liens have been placed, and there's your totals. We'll have a P&L for you for next month.
Yeah, that's and in relation to a lot of that, to compliment Carrie, she has collected over $100,000 in back charges that people have been delinquent on. That's huge.
I'll agree with that.
Huge.
Thank you, Carrie.
Mahalo nui.
Yeah, that's huge in the survival of the district, and to manage that and keep your receivables down,
yeah,
where they're not excessive or anything. It takes a lot of work.
Good business.
Yep,
good business. Good business. Very good. Thank you, Carrie, for that report. This is a request for a motion to adjourn the public meeting for a closed strategy session to discuss the acquisition of real property, including any form of water rights and any pending or reasonable imminent litigation. Do I have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Recognized and seconded. That's by roll call. Carrie?
Trustee Barrett?
Aye.
Trustee Yerding?
Aye.
Trustee Shortell?
Aye.
Trustee Moyle?
Aye.
Trustee Harvey?
Aye.
We're good.
Okay.